in it for the kicks back in my day.
1991. Shane Hennigan and Amon Downs. They met through a record shop where Amon was working. They got together in the studio. They formed the alias of Liquid. They created a four-track EP just for the hell of it. They pressed it to vinyl. A small amount of copies, kind of not really thinking too much of it, got in the right hands. It became an instant must-play at raves, and they completely sold out of them. One of the greatest labels in the world at that time, XL Recordings. In fact, it's the same label that Adele is signed to right now. They came knocking on the door of the Liquid guys in 1992. They signed it and released it to the world 24 years later. And the track, Sweet Harmony, is recognized as one of the biggest piano rave anthems ever. The Liquid story is so very vast and intriguing. I actually spoke to Amon, aka Liquid, for a full hour. How did you and Shane meet to create Liquid?
I was working in a record shop in East London, and it was a bizarre kind of shop because there was a lot of specialist stores, obviously, but ours was also catering to regular mobile DJs. So people would come and buy the chart records to play at weddings as well. And I was working there with another guy who was DJing at a big venue called Labyrinth. It wasn't a big venue, it was quite a big cult underground night. His name was Billy Daniel Bunter, his DJ name. And Shane was a customer in the shop. And the thing about Shane is he always bought... when you're working in a record shop and selling tunes, especially on a Saturday, like you've got the music pumping and there's a bit of a buzz going, and some people will pretty much buy every single track you play. And Shane was very, very specific about what he wanted. He had his own quite unique style, to be honest. And we would obviously talk about music. He had access to a studio, which doesn't sound like a big deal. I mean, now you walk down the street and how many hundreds of people have access to a studio, but this was still a time, talking about like 1991, so studios were still not, I mean, studio equipment was just not generally accessible like it is now. DJ equipment, like if you wanted to buy decks and stuff, for example, that was really expensive, and recording equipment was just not, you didn't have all the online stores and everything, so it just wasn't as it is now, and it's quite easy to forget that. And we just came up with the idea for the tracks, right? Went around his house, the beats, what we were going to sample. And I might oversimplify it, but we just went in and made it. And I think the innocence and the kind of element of naivety helped. I'd had some kind of studio. I'd had, like, Roland drum machines and Yamaha keyboards and stuff like that and a four-track tape machine. But... nothing, it was never really, you could never get any kind of quality to do something. Well, I couldn't get the quality out of it to do something commercial. I was still, from 91, there was a lot of, the UK side of the music was the kind of very, very bassline driven, bleepy stuff, which was really cool. But the Belgian sound has also taken quite a hold. And although I was still into it and I still kind of was still into the tunes, it was starting to feel a little bit like it was deviating from the true nature of house music to me in terms of the kind of, not necessarily soulful element, but it's become a little bit kind of too hard and cold, I guess. And that was one of the motivations as well. And hence why it was like a classic house record that we ended up using as the kind of basis for Sweet Harmony. And from there, it was them just getting it out there. And again, I don't want to sound like an old geezer saying back in my day, but... funnily enough, Daniel, who I worked in the shop with, is doing a book, and he was just saying, have you got any photos? And I was like, we've got no photos of that time, really. And we were just talking, saying, you forget that if you wanted to take a photo back in those days, someone needed to have a camera. And then go and get the film developed and then distribute the photos later. There just wasn't that kind of immediacy in terms of being able to just take a photo there and then put it online immediately, let alone actually have access to a camera. And it was similar once you'd done a track as well. You can do a tune now and you can have it in the hands of DJs and online 5 minutes after you've mastered it, if you can get it out there very, very quickly. But this obviously needs to be distributed properly on vinyl, and so needed to have the money to pay for 500 copies to be pressed, distributed to record shops, etc. But that was all as big a part of the buzz, to be honest. And I always knew in my heart when we did it, we never had any kind of commercial aspirations in terms of crossing over. It was all about making a track that's going to be played at the places where I was going out. That was the objective. But I always knew it was a good track. And but even in early days, the distributor told me we'd be lucky to get rid of the first 500 copies. And I knew he was wrong. And then when it did, I mean, as soon as the vinyl was out on the street, it really, really did kick off. And but even then, record companies, it's changed a bit with a few record companies, especially XL. They're always more progressive than most. But record companies are always very cautious. They want to be absolutely certain that it's going to do well before they sign it. Risk-taking, they're kind of averse to. It's kind of like only asking a girl out when you've got a guarantee that she's going to say yes. So even then, there was this huge peak coming up to Christmas in 1991. And then it felt as almost like there was a drop-off because a couple of record companies were approaching me and dipping their toe in the water, but to be honest, XL was always getting signed to XL was kind of like a dream, really, because if you'd said you're going to do a tune and what's your ideal label, it would always have been XL Recordings. I didn't actually speak to that many labels in the end, but the ones that we did speak to, XL were the only label that were happy to put it out as it was. Everyone else wanted to change it. Which again is a classic record company, which is, this is really, really popular, let's change it. The rest is history, I guess. It's not, I wouldn't say strange, it's amazing that after all these years it's still such a big track, I guess, and I wouldn't say it myself, but other people would say genre defining. I went through a period of wanting to focus much more on the other music that I was doing and getting not annoyed by it, but it just became a kind of overly focused on Sweet Harmony. But then after years, it's not that, how can I phrase it? It's not that I don't care. I don't also just kind of walk down the street wearing a T-shirt saying we made Sweet Harmony. It's just kind of realizing that it is what it is, and it's something to be kind of grateful for. But I don't, it's not only doing that doesn't define me doing music, I guess, doesn't define me anymore. And I think that comes with being a parent, I guess. It helps perspective. So it's kind of like one of the most important things in my life, but it's not like the most important life and death. And it makes it easier, to be honest. So if I'm DJing or playing live now, I guess last 10-15 years I've had much more professional approach, but that comes with being young as well. All of a sudden you're 22-23 years old, playing lots of clubs, being driven raves around the world, being driven everywhere. That lifestyle had an impact on my creativity, let's say. It's almost like the lifestyle became, it wasn't that it was more important, because it was never more important than music, it was always about the music from day one. like I said, it was never, there was never any commercial aspirations at all. But then that way of living became more powerful than the ability to kind of be professional in the studio. And some people I know can get away with it, and I was one of the people who just couldn't really. Good fun, though, from what I remember.
Taking it back, I'd love to, if you can remember, making the Liquid EP.
At the time, in the 90s, when we were working in the record shop, that whole early rave scene wasn't even really called the rave scene, even as it was breaking and charts were going in and tracks were going into like the commercial charts, it was still very, very underground in terms of, it just felt like something that you and your mates did. There was obviously a period in the early 90s where that did cross over into mainstream culture, but like I said, it felt very, very localised. Labyrinth, the club that now is quite legendary, was literally a group of a few hundred people always getting together on Friday and Saturday nights. I think the lack of immediate mass communications helped it keep underground. DJ Lime from SL2 used to come in the record shop. Quite a lot of big radio DJs in the pirate radio DJs did as well. You would talk about music when we saw him in the shop. He'd bring his tracks in, Shut and Dance, used to bring all their promos in. DJ Hype was working at Kicking Records, bring all his promos in. And it used to be just quite standard that, and it would never be, so you're not standing in the shop saying, oh my God, it's DJ Hype or it's Shut and Dance. You're just basically listening to the track, taking a couple of boxes of the track and giving them the money for it. So, and not that it was a business transaction either, it was that's like every day. I guess it's like, I'm trying to think of, if you're Brad Pitt and Angelina Jolie's kids, that becomes, who comes around for dinner, I guess, becomes just quite normal. Oh, look, George Clooney's over. And I wish he'd get off the telly because I want to watch something different. So it was a very kind of, that was just everyday life. And when it progressed into going in the studio, the track only cost £80 to make, and it cost probably about £750 to press and distribute. And although that's not a lot of money, I'm talking 23 years ago, and it was money that I didn't have, my girlfriend at the time, was an artist, and she'd got a scholarship to a London art school, and a lot of the other people that were going there were generally, I don't mean this as a slight, but generally rich kids, like from huge, huge wealthy families. And one of her friends' boyfriends lent me the money to do the pressing and distribution, otherwise. The guy in the record shop might have done, but that maybe would never have happened. I think I went through a period not really being grateful enough to that guy for that. I paid him back, obviously, and gave him good profit, but and I would have had no other way of raising the money. And when we went in and made the initial record, I dabbled a little bit with studio equipment, but I didn't really know my way around a studio. And looking back, it wasn't the slickest studio in the world either. I mean, we did it on an Akai S700 sampler, which was very, very poor quality in terms of the bandwidth. So we had to speed up the beats to like 45 plus 8 to be able to sample them and then slow them back down again. And it kind of impacted on the quality, as you can hear. It didn't impact at all on the vibe of the record, but in terms of, like, if you're a purist in terms of audio quality, you can hear that. And it's only when I really did learn to produce that I looked back on the old Cubase discs for the Atari that we produced it on, and could see that it was kind of a little bit all over the place. But in a way, that's what made it work. I mean, the beats are out of time on Sweet Harmony, but it works. And I think the way music's progressed, now you can correct every single mistake. I mean, I use Logic now, and the software that you have accessible, you can actually you correct every single mistake. And you have to, when I produce now, I try and make sure it doesn't sound, it needs to still have that kind of human element. But it all happened pretty quickly. So the initial EP, we just did that, and Liquid is Liquid was, there was a version of Liquid is Liquid, which was a B-side. And to be honest, we didn't even really have an A-side, B-side mentality. We just needed to fill up the record, the vinyl. And it was actually in shops a few weeks afterwards. And then when XL did sign us, they asked us to do a couple of more tracks. And we literally went in a weekend and did a track called Fog, another one called Music, and a remix of Sweet Harmony that was a little bit more hardcore. Because in the early 90s, people were calling this music hardcore. It was never really called rave. And that pretty much became it. So within a few days, we delivered them their whole first EP. From there, like I said, it's all of a sudden you're going from working in a record shop, just really going out with mates, having kind of, although it's in London, sort of very kind of local lifestyle, I guess. In the late 80s and 90s, I would travel a lot to go to kind of some of the bigger raves, such as Sunrise and Biology and the massive, like 20,000 plus outside the M25 kind of events, but less so in the very early 90s. And all of a sudden you're just kind of doing TV, radio stuff. I think XL Recordings at the time was four people in a very small office, probably the size of the bedroom that I'm speaking to you from now. In fact, probably smaller. Four people cramped into the office, one of which was Nick Hawkes, who went on to start Positiva. Another one, the guy who actually signed us was Richard Russell, who now runs the whole label. It's not that there's not that many people I respect in the music business from the business side, but Richard Russell is definitely one of them. I mean, you look at what he's done for the label, it's amazing. They can put anything out from, they've got that new Special Warfare EP coming out, which is like going back to the XL proper days. And equally, they've got Adele, who's just done a million downloads in the USA. So they're kind of, him and I used to joke to him saying it'd be amazing if you could, for the sake of the label, have a rave record and then a kind of rock set style power ballad on the B-side, and then you'd be able to kind of move out of this office. They haven't done that, but they've kind of obviously now they've managed to become. I can't think of any other label that can have such a mainstream artist and still be putting out really, really underground music. And I think he definitely deserves credit for that. But again, when we first signed, the guy running the label was a guy called Tim Palmer, who'd also had a record store in Soho in London, and. Him and I would go and play pool in the evenings, so it's like the boss of the record company and me, an artist, just out playing pool. It kind of meant it didn't really have that big an impact, but I mean, it's obviously it needs to be a professional relationship, and the business people at Beggars Banquet, who owns XL, are obviously always going to be wanting to kind of cut artist royalty rates, not account properly and stuff, but it was still kind of very much more of a family mentality, even at XL in those days. There was a woman doing press, the two A&R guys, and Tim Palmer, the guy managing the label. And it was just like, again, the feel of the label was very, very much like the feel of the scene at the time. Small and intimate, I guess. I'm not saying that as if it's a bad thing that it's changed, but I think that's why you can't recreate that era the same way you can't recreate King Tubby Records. You can't recreate, you can kind of copy it, and you can produce music to sound like it, but you can't create the actual environment it was made in and it originated from. Like, the reason Sweet Harmony sounds the way it does is because that's all we had access to, and I didn't know any different. If I'd known different, it would have been, we need an S1000, this needs to sound cleaner, we need this kind of studio, we need these facilities, but then who knows, maybe the record would never have worked and would have become too slick. Like I said, I don't think I can really put it any better than that. The music came out of the environment, and looking back, I mean, it's funny because my friend's been writing this book. We've been talking a lot about that period, and don't get me wrong, it was great, it was amazing, but then equally it was still quite, I hope this translates, but it was still a little bit dodgy as well at the time. I think people that weren't around then have it as kind of, it was all just peace and love, and there was an element of that, but there was also an element of kind of criminality, football hooligans, that kind of stuff as well. And it was, I never ever, not in a way that I ever felt threatened, well, there was occasions, but not generally. But it was kind of quite edgy as well. And that's because the environment then is because at first it needed to be like that, I suppose, to operate. And then in the UK, once the press got interested, then there was pressure to do something. So I remember being at raves with 20,000 people and there being 5 to 10 policemen there and the police being okay with it because there was no trouble. I mean, there was logistic problems in terms of someone's going to need to clean this up and make sure we get all these people home without there being major traffic problems. But there was no real, there was no moral outrage at that stage. Then there was a famous headline on the biggest newspaper in England called The Sun, and they just had a photo of a rave, and it was called Ecstasy Airport. And I happened to be at that one as well. And from there it changed, because then the police were under political pressure to close this down. And there was all kind of scare stories, and as you get when mainstream media can sell newspapers on the back of it. And it was all quite funny, really. But over the years, that meant... over the next 5 years, 5 to 6 years, the scene that I'm talking about, which was very local... underground, even in the days when it was 20,000 people, you'd know who was going to the rave. You'd see them on the motorway, you'd see them at the service stations. That was the beginning of it becoming kind of mainstream club culture, I guess, where you did have to then start moving into super clubs just because it had to be organised and licensed. And I know this may sound like a million miles from the whole away from just talking about producing Sweet Harmony, but it was kind of very, very, it was very, very exciting time to be around music because it was just constantly changing. And a trend, like an underground trend, would literally sweep clubs and across the country purely by record shops and raves. I'd have to go, sometimes I'd hear a track before I was working in a record shop, and the only way of getting it would be to go into a record shop and try and sing what you'd heard. Or find the name on a radio station. So you'd had pirate, the only sources of music were really pirate radio, being in a record shop or being at a rave. And there was no way of kind of any other way of finding it. I remember years and years earlier, KLF, What Time Is Love was first out, and I couldn't get it anywhere. And, I mean, I'm not a best singer at the best of time, but I was going in shops just trying to sing, and no one knew what I was going on about. And I think I went to about, I must have gone to about 10, 15 shops before someone was able to kind of recognise my singing. And when I got the track, it was like gold dust. Again, I think I've said it a few times, that doesn't mean then was better than now or now is better than then. It was just very, very different. I'm glad there wasn't video and camera phones at that time, to be honest. It was bad enough someone having a camera sometimes, but God almighty, I'm glad there weren't people videoing some of the stuff that was going on.
Coming back to Sweet Harmony, can you tell me how you came across the samples? So the CC Rogers samples.
Yeah, the samples of Sweet Harmony were a couple of breakbeats, and everyone, a lot of people thought that we sampled the piano, but we didn't. We actually replayed it, only because you can't sample it cleanly from the record. And the vocal, and again, there's other people have like the UK release of Someday by CC Rogers and can't understand where we got the vocal from. But there's an Atlantic Records USA 12 that has a kind of a cappella, it's an a cappella that's got elements of music in, but you can get in Sweet Harmony very, very clean on its own. It's also where that Mickey Finn tune, Some Justice, Urban Shakedown, that sample comes from there as well. Where I'll try and sing it, but it's not going to sound very good, but where it goes, woo, that's from exactly the same a cappella. And funny enough, that was on promo at a similar time. And I remember once we had the Sweet Harmony, Sweet Harmony was like just about to be finished on vinyl, just about to pick them up. And I heard the Mickey Finn tune on the radio. And I just remember listening to it thinking, oh my God, someone else has done a track like it. And I was just dreading hearing the piano. But it didn't have the piano in, so it was cool. That track came from the same... The sample behind that track was from exactly the same mix on the same tune.
Who were some of the people that were playing Sweet Harmony? Maybe some of the people that first picked it up and made it big?
The people I credit with making it really big, to be honest, are... Well, the person, if I'm really honest, is Pete Tong on Radio 1, who had the biggest show at the time on a Friday night. And he also was... It was a Wednesday, and I had the first 500 back, and I took a box to a shop called City Sounds in London. Again, and Ray Keith... Again, I forget all this, actually, but Ray Keith used to work there, and... that's the thing about the shops as well, that... Most of the big DJs now were all working in record shops. They're all very, very... not all of them, obviously, but a lot of them were very, very involved in music 7 days a week. And they took a whole load of records. There was a really nice guy there called Dave, but he was a bit dodgy and tried to sign me on the most ludicrous record deal I've ever seen in my life. But I was like, OK, thank you very much, I'll think about it. But they obviously got the track to Pete Tong. And if I'm honest, Friday nights I was always out or doing other stuff. I never really listened to his show that often because I was working in a record shop Monday to Friday or Monday to Saturday. I didn't really have that. I didn't need to really search out music. I had it in front of me like 8 hours a day. But I put the radio on that night and I just heard the strings playing. And I think that was probably one of the best moments, if I'm honest. That was one of the real genuine dance, jumping up and down on the bed moments because, like I said, we made it to do a big track in a clubs. We made it to make a tune that's going to just stand out in a rave. Didn't even consider... when I say we didn't even consider radio, I'll just pause there. Because Shane and I didn't really know what we were doing, the one thing I look back on and think, why on earth did we put a fade out on a rave record? And I don't remember, to be honest. I would guess it's the influence of people in the studio that were more from kind of mainstream kind of position, but like the engineer or someone. Because why on earth would you put a fade out on a rave tune? But anyway, we did. But it wasn't because of radio. It must have been about 9 o'clock on Friday night and I just heard the strings. And it was just kind of like, oh my God. Despite the life I was leading, I was still very, very kind of like on it and organised in those days. Still am now, to be honest. But Monday morning, I was, okay, right, I'm going to ring up record companies, let them know this is happening. We pressed another 2,000. The guy I was working in the record shop for kindly gave us the money to press the next batch. And it started flying from there. the distributor who had said that we won't even sell 500 was he didn't really have egg on his face, but he was. I had them all at the record shop, and he was coming with his van and picking up 100 here, 100 there, and it was my boss who just said to him, I'm not going to swear, but there was swearing involved, saying, just take the whole lot of them. You're coming back here all the time. You're selling like 100 at every shop you go to. It got massively bootlegged as well. So there was probably, a good 5,000 to 6,000 white labels out before we got signed. But our name was only behind 2,500 of them in terms of I only pressed 2,500 of them. I don't know that for a fact, but I wouldn't stake my life on it. I'd stake my car on it. It's that whole period was a real, real buzz. Hearing it on the radio for the first time, Pete Tong, like I said, Pete Tong was really, really supportive. People that I knew, DJs, were obviously really supportive. All DJs in Labyrinth would be playing it. And then over time, because, again, at that time we were moving into the whole kind of leather trouser, white vest, clubbing stuff in the UK, where there was a beginning of a split actually it wasn't the beginning of a split. The split was becoming more defined between the actual proper rave scene and people going to kind of like Ponzi nightclubs. And a lot of those DJs absolutely hated it. I mean, it's kind of almost anathema to them that we've done this to such a classic record. But then over the years, a lot of those guys play it. I don't know Terry Farley didn't like it at the time, because I don't know that for a fact, but even someone like Terry Farley now plays it occasionally. And it's become one of those tracks, I guess, it's played by DJs that would never have touched it in the day, because there was that other scene going on which was much more about being cool than about music, in my view. I'm sure the music was very, very important, but there was a separate strand about being cool. And one thing about the rave scene, it's become... I mean, at that time, because I was also always been interested in like secondhand record shops as well, at that time in the UK, you would never think ever that the rave records would be the ones that would be sought after in 10, 15, 20 years. You really would think it would be a lot more of the kind of house tunes, because rave was seen as not necessarily a gimmick, but a fad, I guess. And it was you would never have the concept, would still be talking about it 20 years' time. And I never really had enough in their mentality, because I've always been really, really into the music across the board, but I was just never a big believer in, I mean, in a nutshell, I've just never been a big believer in getting dressed up to go out. In the UK, anyway, at that time, the clubs where you did have to wear a shirt and shoes to get into were the ones where you'd most likely get a punch in the face. Saying that, I got held up by a knife in a couple of raves, so that wasn't ideal either, but it's still, I guess, in a more kind of more loving way.
How many copies do you think it sold?
You mean on white label?
Of Sweet Home, say maybe the XL, the original XL recordings one.
Do you know what? I've never got around to checking. I would guess now it must be close to 500,000, I guess. Something I should ask them. They keep meaning to, but I'm just not optimistic that they'll ever give me that kind of information. I guess so, yeah. Or I should ask BPI, I guess. But because initially we pre-sold in the first week before it even went in the shops, they pre-sold close to 100,000.
It's incredible for a... you know, for a vinyl to do that, that's...
Yeah, I mean, when you look at the origins of it, it is incredible. I think it's easy to get kind of all of a sudden when it's incredible. But as you progress through that, it's harder to see that, you know, because what's happening becomes the reality. So working in a record shop, going to raves, going in the studio here and there becomes reality. And that's like day-to-day life. And all of a sudden that changes, and all the travel and the performing. Soon that just becomes the norm. And dealing with record companies becomes the norm. Although it was something that maybe I hadn't been doing at all 6 months earlier, that becomes the norm. And it just becomes familiar, I guess. And you you sometimes need to take a step back and just look and think, it's incredible you've gone from doing a track in a day at a quite basic studio in East London to this being getting licensed globally.
Were there any times that you were kind of cringing a bit at some of the success that you had? More so for, you know, making appearances on stuff like, were you ever on any like chart shows or anything like a Top of the Pops kind of thing?
That's a really good question, actually, because I try not to have regrets, but the one regret, I mean, I don't regret the way that my lifestyle impacted on my career, because that's just the way it was. But the only regret I really do have is there was a big show in the UK called Top of the Pops. I mean, and as a kid, it's the first place I ever saw, like, Debbie Harry, The Specials. Like, so it literally was the kind of show that everyone would watch. And we did that. And at the time, because this music was seen as it was going to kind of destroy society. I mean, literally, SL2 weren't getting radio. SL2 had a record that was number two in the charts, and Radio 1 weren't playing it because they were just, the biggest fear they had was it becoming number one, because the government was, it was just weird. It was just like this whole idea that this music could kind of infiltrate youth culture and kind of poison us all. But I do regret doing that show. So I'm getting off the point. So basically, acts like ours, they insisted you perform live, knowing full well that made it nigh on impossible. So you had to perform the vocals live. I don't mean it sound like a conspiracy theory, but pretty much was that's what's behind it, especially an organisation like the BBC. They control music in the UK at that time, and all this music, which they have no say over, is charting. I was listening back to some of your previous shows, and it was a similar thing with a guy called Gerald. I mean, that record was in the top 20, and mainstream culture happened despite them. They had done nothing to support it, and it showed the power of the kind of underground rave scene and the acid house scene. And but ultimately, it looked shockingly bad, and I knew it. And again, at the time, I was sort of blaming the record company, but I mean, XL were learning as well, and it was such an important show, it needed doing, but it looked so bad. And on the day, I knew it looked bad. I knew this is looking terrible, this is not going to come out well. And it's the one thing from the time that I just can't even watch. I don't watch it because it just doesn't do it justice. We did some kind of more mainstream performances, and we played at a club called the Hippodrome, which was very mainstream at the time, and we did that for a London-based radio station called Capital Radio. But I was always okay doing that because they'd really supported the track. They playlisted it, even though they were a mainstream radio station. Kiss FM, actually, we did a couple of performances for them, and they were a little bit more underground then in the UK, and also they'd really, really supported it. So there was no kind of conflict in doing that stuff, because otherwise it's just being a bit too snobby. Yeah, and again, like I said, it's not the BBC. I mean, I don't know any of this stuff. This is just all based on my kind of rave-fueled perception. The BBC then, Radio 1 now is very, very cutting edge. Radio 1 then was, God almighty, it was full of, like, the sort of DJs you would not want to bump into in a club. Literally, like, shirt undone to the chest, gold medallion, hairy chest, grabbing your girlfriend's ass, pardon my language, kind of DJs. And music for Radio 1 then was pretty much secondary. Now, obviously, you had Pete Tong's specialist shows, and you had a couple of specialist shows in the evenings, but daytime radio was not about music. It was like showbiz. And so for this music to be not only occasionally charting, but dominating the charts when they have no, they're completely disconnected from it, and it's coming from a scene that not only are they not involved with, they completely don't understand. And hence they have to then start, I'm not saying the BBC do this, but then the mainstream press needs to start scaremongering old grannies on the kind of debauchery that's going on. Like I said, the way that the future generation is being kind of completely waylaid by whether it be acid house, rave music, or whatever. I mean, to the extent where there's government bills being introduced to kind of restrict the ability to hold parties.
That was the
Some of the language now, it's almost like satire. There was one bill, criminal. I can't remember which bill it was, to be honest, but the way they described music was repetitive beats.
That was the what they dubbed as the Rave Act.
Yeah.
Something I'd love to know is, where did the name Liquid come from?
I think, do you know what? It's because I'm pretty sure, and again, it's good like that. It's kind of one of those good things. I'm not sure where the name came from. It's because it was just none of this stuff was that planned out or contrived. I'm pretty sure it's because on the other track on the EP, we sampled a sample that just said Liquid from an old US house tune.
And was that Dream to Science?
Yeah, that's the one it was, yeah. And it was because of that we just called the Liquid EP, and the kind of name came from there, to be honest. Because, again, we weren't trying to become an artist or artists or have any kind of profile. And there was no need, again. You know what I mean? You didn't have to all of a sudden have a name and any marketing or a Facebook page. We just called it that, so the EP had a name. And it was just called Liquid EP. And then the tracks obviously had titles, and then we called. How that kind of moved on over the couple of days when we were discussing it is we called one track "Liquid is Liquid," just kind of like because of rhythm is rhythm, obviously, and then it just kind of it became the name.
Speaking of "Liquid is Liquid," that's actually one of my favourite Liquid tunes. Can you talk me through? Just maybe, you know, how you came about that, any particular samples that might be in there or any other influences that you might have gone, hey, I want to write a breakbeat record that sounds more like this or anything like that.
Well, there's a huge dub influence in Liquid is Liquid. And I didn't know this until we started to deal with the publishing, but in dub there's a thing called traditional arrangement, as there is in folk music, which pretty much means that no one really knows who wrote it. And so that's kind of a very famous reggae riff in Liquid is Liquid. And there's no actual samples in it. It's all kind of created, although it's got very, very few musical elements. And it's Liquid is Liquid. I wouldn't say it's my favourite track in terms of, I don't look back and think I've got favourite tracks, but for me it's as important to me personally as Sweet Harmony, obviously not to the vast majority. And because for me it really reflects where Shane and I were both at that time, because Richard Russell was really supportive of it, but other people at XL were saying, if you put this out, it's not going to be a hit. You can't follow up Sweet Harmony with this. We need something like basically Sweet Harmony Part 2. And I'm not sure if you'd be familiar. Don't know. It's not that you wouldn't be familiar with them. They just weren't that well known. There was a band in from the States called Index who had a really big tune called "Give Me a Sign," and I think it's probably '88 on Big Shot, if I remember rightly. And they followed it up with a track called "Now You're Gone," and it was exactly the same tune, just basically with different words. Okay, it wasn't exactly the same, but it was near as damn it. And I was so against that mentality. I was so against just doing a kind of following up with a poorer man's version just to have another big record. And also, just how you can never, those records came, like as we've discussed, Sweet Harmony came about not by accident, but it was created by circumstance. So how can you do that again? And so that was... So it wasn't like deliberately saying we're going to do Liquid Liquid because we're not going to do that, but I just, there was no way I was going to try and do Sweet Harmony Part 2. First of all, because you couldn't, and secondly, just not where I was. I just did not see that's why you did music. I could look back and think it was not the best commercial decision or financial decision that we ever made, but I was quite gung-ho about it at the time, and I still am, to be honest. I really couldn't care less now that we didn't have a series of kind of like mainstream sort of rave pop hits, because it's just never what I wanted to do. And I hated that side of it as well. I hated the kind of I liked the free drink, but I didn't really like any kind of corporate aspect of it, where, I only went a few times, but to kind of like award ceremonies, and the scene was so big at the time. There was one at Albert Hall, and it was Dance Music Awards. I'd meet people, and it'd just be like, oh, hey, love your tracks, love your work. And it was just kind of very, very, it felt very, very false and very, very far removed about from why I'd gone into music. Liquid, we put it out as a single because it was a strong track in its own merit. We weren't trying, at the time, we weren't trying to make a statement. It's only now in retrospect I can look back and see why it came about. But the statement was, if there was one, all I'm saying there wasn't, is that just we put the track is strong in its own right. And it took a real, it took a while to really grow in the UK, because initially, obviously, it's not as radio friendly. It's not a big moment track the same way Sweet Harmony was. It's much more for kind of, I wouldn't say purists, that sounds a bit snobby, but it took a while to grow on people. I remember someone rang me for a few bookings, and I just happened to be going away on holiday, and this must have been about 5 months after the release date, and he was like, why are you going on holiday when your track's so big? I was like, when I booked the holiday, the track had kind of been and gone. So it was kind of like, it was just a little, much more of a grower and a longer term one. Yeah, saying that, Pete Tong was still supportive, Kiss FM was still very, very supportive, we still got sort of good radio on it. But funnily enough, it's people that have kind of got more of a, and again, I'm only using words as they come to mind, I don't mean any of this to start to sound exclusive or snobby, but people that have got more of a pedigree in music that I meet, that I've not really met before, and that I talk to you like I'm talking to you now, tend to always have as much interest in Liquid as Liquid than Sweet Harmony.
And I guess related to that as well, how did you? What were your general thoughts when other people started doing renditions of Sweet Harmony and Liquid as Liquid? Rat Pack had a crack at it. There was like the Speed Garage Serious Danger one. And of course, Danny Bird did quite well. Did quite well in the UK charts with the remake as well.
I guess how I am with people that remake it is I'm always kind of influenced by how people conduct themselves. I guess one thing that made it easier for us to get the samples cleared on Sweet Harmony, we were one of the first people that actually went officially and approached Marshall Jefferson's publishing company. Because we wanted to do it properly. By the time it got to XL, obviously, they had to do that. They had no choice because the track was going to be big. But we still were intent on doing it properly, and they got a huge share, and everyone's happy. So in the case of Danny Bird, their Hospital Records were totally, totally cool the way they dealt with it. They obviously dealt with the record company more than I did, more than they dealt with me, but they were just really, really cool about it, and they were easy to deal with, and they were straight up, and it just then makes it a less of an issue. I'm kind of more put off when people just kind of put tracks out, or people just do a remix and stick it on SoundCloud and start doing free downloads and calling it a remix. Mainly because, maybe I'm old school, but a remix for me is always when the artist had asked you to remix a track. With Liquid is Liquid, because it is a reggae tune that's kind of in the public domain, we don't really have any... obviously we don't have any claims on Sweet Harmony either, but it's not something I stress about, to be honest. There's not that much you can do. There's been a couple of times. Funny, there was one time when one guy had put out Liquid is Liquid rip-off, pretty much, where he'd taken huge chunks of the record and sold a fair amount of records. And I was playing, he happened to be DJing on the same lineup. We were in Spain. And I had, I had a tour manager who was a bit full on, to be fair. He liked an argument, is one way of putting it. And he was a bit aggressive with this guy. He didn't like, not physically, but he was saying, you need to sort yourself out, you need to burn. And although it was kind of like right in principle, because if it was me, not that I would have done, but if I bootleg someone's record and then I'm playing with them, I maybe drop them a message before I bump into them at the venue. And the promoter was quite a funny guy. If you didn't know him, you'd think he'd walked out of the set of kind of like Scarface or Carlito's Way. He was very kind of like jovial gangster, but he wasn't actually like that type, but that's how he appeared. And he was loving it because he was saying, he's going to be in big trouble, he's going to be in big trouble when he sees you. And for me, those kind of scenarios are avoided just by being up front. And like Hospital Records, really, really up front. And a few other people just haven't been. And like I said, I don't stress about it. But if they're going to sit down and be in the same dressing room as you, it's just kind of a little bit of a kind of... it's not a very well thought out way of conducting yourself. And it's pretty much a life principle, I guess. If you've... it goes beyond music. It's just... I'm obviously by no means perfect, but I do my best just try not to be an idiot in other people's lives. When it comes down to it is, I think it would be a bit rich if I was kind of claiming too much for people using that piano, either of those piano riffs, because we borrowed them as well.
Moving on, so Liquid had, kind of the output that you did, you know, there was only kind of a little bit here and there, and then a couple of remixes and some other bits and pieces. So when did, or has Liquid kind of just run its course, or is it still a thing that you're sort of actively sort of involved in or planning to do later on if the opportunity arose?
Bits and pieces, to be honest. I've had periods where I've done some stuff. I've had periods where I've been doing other stuff. I've been doing a few Liquid tracks at the moment, actually, for the first time in a while. I got into doing a little bit more sort of electronic dub and reggae for a period, because I'd always been like that's the kind of music I grew up on. Having a family, I think, had a big effect. I know that sounds like a cliche because it does on everyone, but for me, I wanted to stop travelling as much, not be away from my daughter when she was born, and I guess priorities change as well. And I think as well, what really changed me is being less defined by doing music all the time, which sounds weird actually, because it's made it easier now to produce over the last few years, because I'm kind of precious about it in a sense of the tracks need to be exactly right before they get out, but I'm less precious about what people think about them. And I mean, to be honest, I was never that bothered on that front. I had periods where I used to hate bad DJ returns, and you could have like 95 good DJ returns, and I would focus on the 5 bad ones, but not for very long. But answering the question, yes, I've been doing music. I've been carrying on doing Liquid stuff here and there. I've been playing live and DJing most of the time, although with a few breaks where I just haven't really... taken bookings, but I'm also, that always creates a conflict for me, because I'm not a big believer in ever turning down work. Not that it's work, but I still remember that when I was working in the record shop, I was bitten the hand off to have been given the opportunities I've been given, so I don't take them for granted either. But equally, I mean, I got offered a I mean, just give you some examples. Like, I got offered a Christmas Eve booking, and I would have been on my own away, like two flights away from home. And the way I look at it is, I've got, I mean, although I'm getting older, I've still got plenty of time to be doing music, but I don't want to miss Christmas morning with my daughter. So I guess, yeah, life changed is one answer. But yeah, I still do quite a lot of production as well. I know that's kind of quite a long-winded answer to your question.
No, that's fine, because it's actually leading into what musical projects do you have on the go?
Well, I've got on the go, like, so I've been doing a few Liquid tracks with a few vocalists that I've met. And what's quite interesting, and that's come about from people that are younger but are into that scene. So there's a guy called Romper from some Urban Nerds that were quite big promoters in the UK, and I got hooked up with him, and he kind of knows a lot of the guys from Swamp 81 and a lot more of the kind of the new underground, and they're kind of like influenced quite, not necessarily influenced, but big fans of that era of music. And so then just by being around people like that, I started doing some more tracks now with some vocalists that he knows. I've been finishing off some reggae tracks that I've had on the go for a while, and when I say reggae, it's like more electronic reggae, really, like electronic dub. I was working with a guy called Spider, who had that big track, Tarantula, and God Almighty, I can't remember the name of the band.
Pendulum.
That's the ones. Yeah. And I've also got a couple of tracks on the go with a guy called L16, who, again, he's very, very well known within the reggae scene, but he's more well known in ours because he sang on a couple of Left Field tracks. He's the one who sang the vocal on Ease the Pressure, and he's performed live with them a couple of times. And what the good things about that, I mean, doing the vocal sessions, and I'm not saying this to be dramatic, but watching L16 sing the vocals when we did the vocals in the studio, it came pretty close to literally bringing tears to my eyes, just to watch him perform and the way he's got like the sweetest voice you can imagine. And also, not only that, he's someone, it's like, I wouldn't say he's a hero like that, but working with someone that's just been such an influence was just, again, that's only part of it. Obviously, the idea of doing music is as many people as possible get to hear it. But those kind of moments, I guess, are the things that you remember. Like, again, I remember that. I remember, like I described to you earlier, the kind of jumping up and down feeling on the bed when Pete Tong plays the records. Because otherwise, it becomes business-like, obviously, and it's easy to kind of, when it does become the daily norm, it can be quite easy just to kind of lose those magical moments in the kind of the bigger issues. And I don't mean bigger issues, but I mean when you get back from playing for a weekend and you've been sitting around airports for a few hours here and there and tired, it can be quite easy just to forget the real kind of reasons for doing music in the first place. That's why, although it was kind of quite short-lived in how funny it was, that DJ's complaining Twitter account was brilliant. I don't know if you saw it, but they would basically retweet anything from DJ's complaining. Some of it would be the most overly self-entitled stuff you could think about, like getting the steak wrong or the steak being overcooked. I can honestly still remember when I was working in the record shop, opening records, playing records to people, that I would have given anything to be involved in music. So I never, ever lose that kind of that perspective, to be honest.
In it for the kicks, the electronic music show with Greg Churchill and Nick Collings, Friday nights, 10 till midnight on Radio Hauraki.